Welcome to this 14th edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the 7th chapter, titled Human Life, Part 1. Chapter 7, Human Life. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment. Mark chapter 12, verse 30, New Testament. In the first commandment, we see the four aspects of human life: heart, soul, mind, and strength. If we humans were only one thing, four wouldn't have been mentioned. It's not unprecedented to find multiple aspects to the human personality discussed by philosophers and sages throughout history. Will Durant, The Story of Philosophy, page 22, quotes Plato regarding three of the four aspects of human personality. Quote, human behavior flows from three main sources: desire, emotion, and knowledge. Desire, appetite, impulse, instinct, these are one. Emotion, spirit, ambition, courage, these are one. Knowledge, thought, intellect, reason, these are one. Desire has its seat in the loins. It is a bursting reservoir of energy, fundamentally sexual. Emotion has its seat in the heart, in the flow and force of the blood. It is the organic resonance of experience and desire. Knowledge has its seat in the head. It is the eye of desire and can become the pilot of the soul. Quote, desire, physical body or might. Emotion, heart. Knowledge, mind. Add to that the fourth aspect outside of ourselves, the family, group, club, or whatever gathering we belong to, and we have four elements. The four aspects were scattered throughout ancient thinking. Quote, Jewish tradition held that Adam was composed of earth, taken from the four corners of the world, representing the four basic elements of the earth. Earth, water, air, and fire. The four humors of man in medical alchemy, and for the Egyptians, the four basic colors and the four races of man. Hugh Nibley previously cited One Eternal Round, page 301. Native Americans observed the four cardinal directions of the compass, assign colors to them, black, yellow, red, and white, and assign four different spirits or aspects to each. Stephen Jay Gould notes in The Lying Stones of Marrakesh, page 285, that the number four comes up much in ordering our lives. Quote, Carl J. Jung, famed psychiatrist, strongly felt that division by four represented something deep and archetypical in human proclivities. There's a balance in the number four. The compass is balanced between the four directions, so it forms a cross and can be balanced and spin freely when a center point is placed between north and south, east and west. Medieval medicine had it that we had four humors, or different types of personality, depending on the makeup of our blood. Gould remembers, previously cited, quote, we parsed many other phenomena into schemes with four end members, four ages of man, four Greek elements of earth, air, fire, and water. We may experience four as an ultimate balance because such schemes fill our mental space with two favorite dichotomies in perfect and opposite coordination. The great psychologist Sigmund Freud listed three within the human personality, id, ego, and superego, then included a fourth outside of us, the outside world. The id is the animal or impulsive instinct of Plato. The ego is consciousness, intellect, and reason, constantly battling the id to keep it managed via rational thought. And the superego is the nagging parent, which tries to enforce morality via guilt. I don't want to put words in Freud's mouth. He was an atheist and certainly wasn't exploring these aspects of human personality to fit with a religious principle. I'm just borrowing his shoes, as it were, and putting them on different feet. Feet for which they were never intended, but for which there's at least a loose fit. Psychiatrist Carl J. Jung states in his book, Modern Man in Search of a Soul, page 93, quote, "I have worked out a fourfold classification corresponding to the functions of thinking, feeling, sensation, and intuition. I have been asked almost reproachfully why I speak of four functions and not of more or fewer. That there are exactly four is a matter of empirical fact. A certain completeness is attained by these four. Sensation establishes what is actually given. Thinking enables us to recognize its meaning. Feeling tells us its value. And finally, intuition points to the possibilities of the whence and whither that lie within the immediate facts." End quote. Though not an exact fit with heart, might, mind, and strength, it is at least a reaffirmation of four as the accepted number of aspects of human nature. Professor Michio Kaku writes of four aspects to human life, also not in specific relation to the Great Commandment, but I feel there is a workable similarity here. In Parallel Worlds, he states, quote, "I believe that Sigmund Freud came closest to the truth when he said that what gives stability and meaning to our minds is work and love. Beyond work and love, I would add two other ingredients that give meaning to life. First, to fulfill whatever talents we are born with. Second, we should try to leave the world a better place than when we entered in." End quote. Page 359. Work, love, talents, and social contribution. I'd shoehorn those into the categories of soul, heart, mind, and strength. These will be defined and looked at separately as we go. A further surfacing of these four aspects, in Greek culture around Socrates' time, there were four cardinal virtues: wisdom, courage, moderation, and justice. And these translate, by the wave of Mr. Hazel's magic shoehorn, into wisdom is mind, of course, courage is heart, moderation is the control of the body, and justice is our actions towards society or our group. Freud and Plato list three within the human soul, Kaku four. Three within is with Freud and Plato, and one outside. I used to go with three myself. My dad taught me that man was like a three-legged stool, spirit, mind, and body, and that all legs had to be of equal length or the stool would rock and tip. This probably is why I keep saying balance, balance. I later was convinced that the fourth aspect, our family, group, or social milieu, had to be added, for we are social beings. We don't function alone. No man is an island. And we are greatly influenced by our society. Call the fourth aspect strength. Jesus Christ himself showed growth in these four aspects. Quote, "And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man." End quote. Luke 2:52. Wisdom would be mind, stature, soul, or the growth of the physical body. Favor with God would be spirit or heart. And favor with mankind would be his social development. And one more take, not so much to fill space, but to give emphasis to the fact that this phenomena has been nearly universal. C.S. Lewis, in Mere Christianity, previously cited, lists four cardinal virtues from the Latin concept of a hinge on a door, which is important for hanging the door and allowing it to swing open or shut, page 74. Quote, "They are prudence, temperance, justice, and fortitude." End quote. We notice two of these straight from the Greek, temperance and justice, temperance being moderation. Prudence, for Lewis, means practical common sense, or we might say mind, and fortitude equals courage or heart. To sum up then, four things working together define what it means to be human. In arbitrary, not particular order. 1. Work or physical labor or our body, id, soul. 2. Love or the spiritual connections to the God who created us and our brothers and sisters created also in his image, superego, heart. 3. Talent improvement or the development and increase of our intelligence or brain, ego, mind. And 4. World improvement, making things better for our fellow beings and ourselves, strength. I hope to show in loose generalities and vaporous definition at best how these four aspects make up our humanness. A quick word as to the definition of soul. I had to go down 7 definitions in the dictionary before I could get one that would mean corporeal body, as in not a soul was here. The first definition is the spiritual, immaterial, and immortal part in man as distinguished from the body. It would seem, then, that our definition for soul should be spirit. But since we are asked to love God with all our soul and heart, and since our hearts are the seat of our desires, inclinations, and, most importantly, love, I've arbitrarily relegated soul to mean the physical body, and heart to mean spirit. We must also realize that we can't completely separate any of these elements, that they are all connected with each other, though we can see a distinctness in each of them. Like picking out the ingredients of a stew, one can identify a piece of potato, carrot, beef, or celery, yet each has the flavors of the others, each has given of its flavor to the stew, and they're all one, in that they're all stew, as previously mentioned. But what are heart, soul, mind, and strength? I wish I had a definitive statement for each. The best I can do on this is to remember a college philosophy class taught at Brigham Young University by Professor Chauncey Riddle. He based a good portion of his philosophical and eschatological approach to life on the four aspects of human nature and defined them thus. Heart is our premortal spirit, that life which was, as previously discussed, birthed in heaven from heavenly parents, and is a real life entity on its own, thinking, acting, growing, and developing. Soul is the combination of that spirit with a mortal body. For purposes of this discussion, we use the word soul to describe mainly the physical body and the animal instincts, impulses, and passions that come with it. It's not the best use of the word soul, but we have to have some pigeonholes here, and that's where soul is going to be stuck for current purposes. Mind is our intellect, our brain, the rational part of our thinking processes. Strength is our group. This could be family, social club, school class, church population, national origin, ethnic and racial groupings. Any one of us is a member of several groups at once, just by virtue of birth and existence in a community. Let's look in depth at each one of these aspects of our nature and find out more about ourselves and humanity in general. Perhaps Professor Riddle got to me more than I realize. I see the four aspects of man coming together often. Consider Christ's counsel to his apostles. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Matthew 10:16, New Testament. Sheep, wolves, serpents, and doves. Four animals symbolizing the four aspects. Sheep would be heart or the spirit child of God. Wolves would be strength or the social group milieu. Serpents, in this case, wise as serpents, would be our intellect or mind, and doves would be the physical or soul, might, and an example of how we should use our physical strength, that is, harmlessly. First, heart or spirit. We've discussed the premortal existence of ourselves as spirit children of heavenly parents. That spirit comes to earth to be born into a mortal body for this very important part of our eternal development. Yes, in the body of a tiny baby resides a fully grown, mature adult spirit. But that spirit, to get the full benefit and opportunity for new development, must lose all memory of its previous existence and cope with the difficulties, temptations, and choices of mortality with only the inertia and subconscious memories of the storehouse of knowledge and maturity that it gained in the premortal state. Earlier in this book, we showed how some skipped out of their schooling and ducked their educational responsibilities in the premortal existence. Those actions will show up now as they have a more difficult battle with mortal trials. Many have thought that spirit was simply a spark, a breath from God that vanished as a gust of wind upon the death of the body. Another word to describe spirit was insubstantial, as in George Ritchie's usage previously cited in Return from Tomorrow. I believe there's a lot more to spirit than gust of wind or spark. In My Descent into Death, pages 10 through 12, previously quoted, Howard Storm observes his spirit thus, quote, "I was aware that I felt more alert, more aware, and more alive. All my senses were extremely vivid. The linoleum tiles on the floor were slick and cool, and my bare feet felt moist and clammy against them. The mix of odors of stale urine, sweat, residue of bleach from the sheets and enamel paint filled my nostrils." End quote. He describes other sensations from all five of his senses, concluding that in his spirit form, he was now more alive than he had ever been. This more alive observation is common among near-death experiencers. From Life in the World Unseen, previously quoted, it seems that spirits get a bit huffy when we mortals denigrate them and their surroundings. Page 16, quote, "They would take away from us our beautiful countryside, our flowers and trees. By their own stupid admissions, no conception whatever, they would turn us into wraiths without substance, without intelligence, and merely surviving in some dim, shadowy, vaporous state. I am forcibly impressed by the magnitude of ignorance shown by particular minds on earth." End quote. It seems to be a foregone conclusion to Carl Jung that the spirit is a real entity that needs consideration. In his book previously cited, page 173, he writes, quote, "It was universally believed in the Middle Ages as well as in the Greco-Roman world that the soul is a substance." His footnote to that reads, "that which has independent existence." Indeed, mankind as a whole has held this belief from its earliest beginnings, and it was left for the second half of the 19th century to develop a psychology without the soul. Under the influence of scientific materialism, everything that could not be seen with the eyes or touched with the hands was held in doubt. The spirit in itself was considered as a being without extension. Afterwards as well, it was considered as timeless and hence immortal. Page 181. It is moving force, that is, life force. Apostle Parley P. Pratt of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints wrote that the spirit, quote, "possesses every organ after the pattern and in the likeness or similitude of the outward or fleshly tabernacle it is designed eventually to inhabit. Its organs of thought, speech, sight, hearing, tasting, smelling, feeling, etc., all exist in their order as in the physical body, the one being the exact similitude of the other." Key to the Science of Theology, page 56. Storm describes the reality of his spirit body. Quote, "I squeezed my fists and was amazed how much I was feeling in my hands just by making a fist. I could feel the bones in my hands, the muscles expand and contract, skin pressed against skin. My head, shoulders, arms, abdomen, and thighs were all intact. I pinched myself and it hurt." He then describes his mortal body, which appeared dead, describing it as a slab of meat in the supermarket. Like other spirit near-death experiences, He tries to communicate with his wife and another patient in the hospital room, but they are incapable of hearing him. Though this is the best description I've read of the spirit as real and tangible, at least to other spirits, it is by no means uncommon that he can't communicate with mortals, as many near-death experiencers have reported. Previously cited, pages 10 through 12. It is interesting to note that as tangible as his spirit is to Storm, that it is intangible to the mortal world. George Ritchie observed that the spirits in the bar trying to get a drink passed their hands and arms through the wooden counter. They were further observed diving into the unconscious bodies of the passed-out drinkers. There seems to be two kinds of substantiality here, spirit and mortal. How can one material substance, spirit, inhabit the space occupied by a second material substance, mortal, for two things can't be in one space at the same time? My speculative answer is this. As solid as we think we mortal beings are, there really isn't much to us. If all the space between our atoms and electrons were eliminated, we'd be compressed into something no larger than a cube of sugar. That cube would weigh as much as we do, but in terms of size, it would be a minute fraction of what we currently are. In other words, there's a lot of empty space in us, not just between our ears. I think it's possible for spirit material, whatever it is, to inhabit that space. Can we call it quantum tunneling? Perhaps. Quantum tunneling is the theoretical physical phenomenon wherein one set of matter can pass through another via the open spaces in the molecules and atoms. It's theoretical physics at this point. At least we can't use it to escape through the solid walls of a prison, but it's not a blatant impossibility. From Melvin Morse's collection of children's near-death experiences, Closer to the Light, previously cited, there's this interesting report of a spirit re-entering its body after its near-death experience. Quote, "While I was thinking about whether to stay or return, I felt myself enter my body. I was about the size of a BB when I went into my body. Then I expanded and filled up the space." Page 180. This would give a spirit a gas-like quality, expanding to fill the limits of its space. To give an illustrative metaphor to this, take a glass and fill it with sand. Is that glass full? Yes, but you can still take a good quantity of water and fill that same glass again, the water seeking out the open spaces between sand grains. The sand has a coarse tangibility to it. Seen under a microscope, there's a lot of space between the grains. The water has a finer tangibility to it, though still coarse matter of the material realm. It is capable of filtering in and around the sand grains. The point is that spirit and matter, though both having a substantiality of their own, can still coexist in the same place. Christ, after his resurrection, appeared to his apostles through the walls of a locked room, John chapter 20, verse 26, though he made it clear that he wasn't a spirit, but a solid flesh and bone being. Quote, "But they were terrified and affrighted, and supposed that they had seen a spirit. And he said unto them, Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit hath not flesh and bones, as ye see me have." End quote. Luke 24, 37 through 39, New Testament. To give further proof of his literal resurrected tangibility, he showed them his hands and feet, presumably still bearing the nail imprints, and then he ate some broiled fish and honeycomb, as reported in verses 42 through 43. It would seem to me from this instance that a resurrected immortal being, such as Christ, possesses both spirit and temporal tangibilities. He can quantum tunnel, if that's the correct scientific term, for his ability to appear and disappear through our mortal solidity at will. But he can also exercise the prerogatives of the mortal world, such as being touched and eating, thereby demonstrating an inner and outer tangibility as to the crude material world we currently inhabit. This is a bit more on the spirit nature of mortal man that I wanted to cover here, but Christ's resurrection is the destiny of all of us, a miraculous recombining of spirit and our current matter, turned into immortal and perfected to become a resurrected immortal being. Angie Fenimore, Beyond the Darkness, describes the substance of the spirit world in these terms, quote, "I sensed that the molecular makeup of everything around me, the furniture and the ground, was thinner than the things of the earth, so that here things seemed less solid, though they were far more real, indestructible," page 107. Thinner molecules. I know of nothing in theoretical physics that would correspond with that, unless it's dark matter and energy, those mysterious, relatively new theoretical substances that have to make up a good 93% of the universe, or else some numbers arcane and mysterious to me just don't crunch. And that's only ignorant speculation on my part, more of which will come in a later chapter as we discuss the physical nature of the cosmos. And yet we note again that the realities of the spirit world seem much more real than those of our real world. Which is the greater or at least truer reality? I can only think of a metaphor. I've done a couple small theater productions. I love it and wish I could do more, but schedule and time don't permit. Anyway, in one I had a soliloquy moment of sorts with the audience. In one half of my brain, the right half I presume, I was playing my character, but with the other half I was monitoring audience reaction to see if they got what I was doing. Each night I could hear murmured uh-ohs, and the half of my brain that was somewhat detached from my play-acting half gave me a psychological high-five. I knew I'd pulled it off, and I went on. Of course, the audience never knew of this duality in me as I was performing, because the actor can't break character and congratulate the audience on getting his bit. I think the spirit and mortal world are overlain somewhat like a play. The big reality is the audience and the world outside, to which we will return after our production. But the play is what we're in now, and we can't break character. We must go on. There is a relationship between the spirit and the mortal body. From Lundahl and Widdowson's The Eternal Journey, previously cited, page 107, "Now I understood that it is the spirit that gives the power to the mortal body of flesh and bones to function and keep it alive. I think we can compare the spirit and body to a driver and a car. Until I get in my pickup and turn the key, it is an inert mass of steel, plastic, and rubber. A space alien observing Earth for the first time might think our automobiles are the resident life forms on this planet. They have motion, emit waste, take on food, fuel. But then we'd park and get out, and the alien would have to reconfigure his report. If I were to get in a wreck and total my truck, I'd have to leave it and resign it to the recycling yard. But I'd still be alive, assuming I survived the accident. It's the same with our bodies. Our spirits are the drivers, and when we leave our bodies, they die and decay back to earth. But the point is, when God asks us to love him with all our heart, spirit, he is asking us to love him with something that is real, that is us, or at least part of us, and I would say the most important part of what we are. Remember from the Eschatological Outlook chapter, it's not that we are mortals having spiritual experiences. It's that we are spiritual beings having a mortal experience. As mentioned, there has been confusion as to what the spirit really is. It's pretty hard to love deity with something that is insubstantial and vanishes upon death. God wants our love to begin in eternity and exist through all eternity. Of the four aspects of human life, only the spirit fills that role, and thus our spirits, or hearts, should take the lead in managing and directing the other three aspects of our lives. Our minds developed as we progress to higher life forms, and should continue to develop. Our mortal bodies are temporary, and began only with our mortal birth, which came long after our spirit bodies came forth in heaven. We will regain a tangible body of flesh and bone in the resurrection, as Christ did. See the above references from Luke and John. Our social groups change. Our spirit is where we began our most intimate relationship with God when we were born as his son or daughter. That leaves our minds, bodies, and social groups to discuss. I've said quite a bit about the body in relation to the spirit above. Let's go there. I've often said to my son that having a mortal body is like having a high-spirited dog, which we have, a husky shepherd mix. He's a good dog, but absolutely must be kept on a leash, or he'll run off chasing the neighbor's horses, knocking over small children, not out of meanness, but of an overwhelming desire to play, and digging up their yards. We obviously can't have that. The few times he's gotten loose, when we've tried to call him back, he basically looks at us and says, "Go to hell," and takes off. But he's just a dog. He's just being the dog he chose to be. It's our responsibility to be sure he's on a leash and under control. The same can be said for our physical bodies. They're just matter, and their desires and impulses are those of their animal nature. The problem is we have no excuse for letting them run uncontrolled, following their animal instincts, for inhabiting our bodies is a spirit son or daughter of God. One of the greatest learning experiences and responsibilities of this mortal life is keeping this animal body of ours under proper restraint. Prisons are full of those who can't. The poorer sections of town are populated by those who had children without thought for a stable and provident home for them, sometimes coupled with subjugation to their body's craving for drugs. I'm not going to moralize greatly here. Not everybody who's poor is on drugs or has made bad choices. They may have just been laid off or downsized. But anyway, a moment's reflection will show what harm is done to society by letting our body's physical desires have domination over our spirit's responsibility and mandate to follow spiritually mature principles. The purpose of life is the development of the soul, the combination of body and premortal existent spirit. Giving a complete sway to our body's uncontrolled drives seriously hampers and can ultimately destroy that development, as discussed earlier on the nature of sin and evil. Henry David Thoreau, Walden Pond, writes of the conflicting animal nature within us, quote, "We are conscious of an animal in us which awakens in proportion as our higher nature slumbers. It is reptile and sensual, and perhaps cannot be wholly expelled. That in which men differ from brute beast," says Mencius, "is a thing very inconsiderable. The common herd lose it very soon. Superior men preserve it carefully." Mencius was perhaps the most famous student of Confucius. The uncontrolled body would tend towards evil, but it is not evil in itself. It is simply the physical creation it is supposed to be. We, like putting my dog on a leash, are under the responsibility to keep it under proper restraint and control. Alan Bloom addresses this duality in his The Closing of the American Mind, page 71. Quote, "Civilization, or to say the same thing, education, is the taming or domestication of the soul's raw passions, not suppressing or excising them, which would deprive the soul of its energy, but forming and informing them as art. The goal of harmonizing the enthusiastic part of the soul with what develops later, the rational part, is perhaps impossible to attain, but without it, man can never be whole. Music or poetry, which is what music becomes as reason emerges, always involves a delicate balance between passion and reason, and even in its highest and most developed forms, that balance is always tipped, if ever so slightly, toward the passionate. Some excuse our animal actions by saying we are animals in nature from evolution. That is only 1/4 correct. And it's no more an excuse to give free rein to our animal instincts than it is for a man to sexually assault every female he sees just because he has testosterone. This animal being we call a body is a talent from God, and like other talents mentioned previously, he's going to hold us accountable for how we use it. Care for the body is obvious. Cleaning it, brushing the teeth, proper diet, exercise. You all know the drill. Those who believe it's spiritually correct to mortify the flesh in an outward display of subjecting it to the spirit miss the point. This gift of God requires proper care and maintenance and was not meant to be abused. Balance. Yes, balance. Joyce H. Brown's near-death experience, Heavenly Answers to Earthly Questions previously cited, gives information on the importance of the body. Prior to her experience, she had felt her body to be inadequate, too old, too ill, too heavy. Quote, "When I watched my life review," she writes, "it became clear what a valuable gift my body was and how necessary it was to accomplish what I desired to do during earth life. My body was precious and vitally important for many reasons, and that without it, I could not even pick up a piece of paper. It gave me freedom as well, the freedom to act, to do the things I chose to do, and to participate in earthly experiences." Page 107. The body can be a wonderful instrument for the worship and love of God, and this is one reason it is included in the commandment to love God with all four aspects of our lives. Consider how David has showed his love for God in his dancing. Quote, "And David danced before the Lord with all his might, King David leaping and dancing before the Lord." End quote. Old Testament, 2 Samuel 6, verses 14 through 16. The body is a great instrument to physically demonstrate the inner feelings of the spirit. It is also with the body that we physically help others, helping them shovel their walk after a winter storm, picking up and comforting an upset child, the tender touches and caresses that show our inner feelings of love. Without the means to physically express our inward spiritual realities, we'd be frustrated in the extreme, like those poor suicides mentioned in the preceding chapter, who had no physical means to show their sorrow and regret for their actions and the love they still had for their families and friends they had betrayed. Many religions claim there will be no physicality in the cosmos, that this mortal body is a curse and a burden, that its creation from the dust of the earth is an offense to heaven. This isn't so. I won't dwell greatly on the philosophical aspects of this attitude, much of which comes from both Greek and Oriental thinking, but as a Christian, I celebrate and believe in the tangible flesh and bone resurrection of Jesus Christ, and that that event is held out to all of us as a promise. Let me just refer to a few scriptures from the Concordance in my Bible. Job expresses the faith that even though his body is destroyed, yet in his flesh he'll see God. Job 19:26. Isaiah speaks of the dead rising. Isaiah 26:19. Matthew reports that at the resurrection of Christ, the graves were opened and many came out of them and appeared to many. Matthew 27:52-53. The resurrected Christ demonstrated to his apostles that he wasn't a spirit, but had a body of flesh and bones, which I would add was inhabited by his immortal and eternal spirit. Luke 24:39. And to sum it up, Joyce Brown in Heavenly Answers to Earthly Questions as to her near-death experience in the spirit world writes of her desire to regain her physical body. Quote, "A desperate longing for my physical body overwhelmed me. I was drastically more limited without my body than I had been with it. I wanted to communicate with my family to tell them I loved them and missed them, but I could not." Page 40. In short, do you as a Christian not believe in the literalness of these sources, that they are all figurative, and that there will be no tangible resurrection for us? Then why do you celebrate Easter? The concept of the resurrection was one of the early schisms in the Christian church, as Greek philosophy from Paul's converts seeped into the original pure teachings of Christ to his apostles. See 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 12. That whole chapter deals with Paul's reminding the Corinthians of the literality of Christ's resurrection. And thus we conclude this 14th podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Human Life, Part 2, and we'll deal with the remaining two aspects of human life, mind and society. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in, and special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com, hazelleproductions.com, and thank you.